Happy Hump Day, Oregon! I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Wednesday, so this is an archive show, but it last aired 2 to 10 years ago, so unless you're a hardcore, long-time listener, it's probably new to you. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on March 24th of 2024. Under the headline, Klondike Kate and the Case of the Fake Cat Fight. It is a rewritten, re-researched version of a much shorter article which was published originally in August 14th of 2011. Here we go. Imagine this story playing out on a television or movie screen near you, or a vaudeville stage better yet. Fade in on a tall, rugged-looking woman in a bright red Sergeant Preston of the Yukon outfit. We hear a voiceover from a gravel-voiced narrator.
It was June of 1901. In the territorial capital of Whitehorse, Klondike Kate Ryan was the first woman officer in the history of the Royal Northwest Mounted Police, a precursor agency to the famous Royal Canadian Mounted Police, a.k.a. the Mounties.
We see a slow montage of Klondike Kate out on the streets of Frontier Whitehorse doing Mountie stuff, perp-walking crooks up the jailhouse steps, tacking up wanted dead or alive posters at the livery stable, and so forth, while the narrator continues.
The Klondike Gold Rush was at its height in the summer of 1901, so Klondike Kate had plenty to keep her busy. From Whitehorse to Dawson City, the Yukon Territory was crawling with unruly gold miners, or sourdoughs as they were called. For Klondike Kate Ryan, it was all in a day's work. But then, one day, Klondike Kate's supervisor suddenly called her into the office. She wondered if she'd made a mistake or something. What could he want?
Here we cut to scene two, the interior of a Frontier police office with rifles on the wall and a big Canadian flag in the corner. A uniformed supervisor is sitting behind a desk, glaring at Klondike Kate Ryan, who looks shocked. Supervisor, angry, shouting,
Officer Ryan, what's this I hear about you moonlighting as a slutty exotic dancer in variety theaters and gentlemen's clubs? I can't have vaudeville hussies on the force. What have you got to say for yourself?
Klondike Kate, baffled.
I don't know what you're talking about, sir. I can't dance. I can't talk. Only thing about me is the way I perp-walk the crooks up the jailhouse steps. Like that vaudeville dancing hooker I busted for prostitution a couple months ago, for instance. What was her name? Kitty something.
Well, that's not what our sources are telling us. They say you're dancing in your underwear on the stage in front of a bunch of leering perverts and filthy sourdoughs 6 nights a week. Just look at this filth.
With that, supervisor holds up a handbill that reads Klondike Kate's Exotic Frolics. She dances for your enjoyment at the Palace Grande Theater 6 nights a week. Klondike Kate Ryan, puzzled but with dawning comprehension.
Wait a minute, the Palace Grande, that's that dingy doggery out of which that skanky hussy kitty what's-her-name was working when I busted her for selling her sweet favors to sourdoughs. As she was going off to serve her month of hard labor for aggravated prostitution, I remember her glaring at me and swearing that she would get me back. This is her revenge, identity theft. She's stolen my nickname to get even with me. Can there be any other explanation?
Well, yes, there can, but I'll give you 24 hours to round up proof that this striptease tart is someone other than you. After that, you'll be fired.
I'll get that proof, sir, and save my reputation and my job. You can count on me, sir.
Transition to scene three, outside the front door of a grubby, disgusting-looking gentleman's club in the crappy part of town. A red light hangs over the door. Klondike Kate Ryan marches up to it and yanks it open and enters. Cut to scene four.
In the gloomy, disgusting interior of the Frontier Gentlemen's Club, Klondike Kate can see her self-proclaimed nemesis on the stage at one end, capering about suggestively in a state of near-total undress while a bunch of filthy, unruly sourdoughs leer and holler catcalls at her. The dance number finishes, and the curtain comes down for intermission. Klondike Kate balls up her fists and storms up to the stage and jerks the curtain aside to enter. Cut to scene 5, in the backstage area. Fake Klondike Kate stands in her skimpy stage outfit. She looks startled at first, and then a malicious smile touches her features. Fake Klondike Kate.
Well, if it isn't Officer Righteous herself, how do you like these apples, you holier-than-thou harridan?
Real Klondike Kate, angry and shouting. Stop calling yourself Klondike Kate, you brazen strumpet! Fake Klondike Kate, scornfully.
Forget it. That's my nickname now. It started as a plan to get revenge on you, but I've decided I like it. Now all I have to do to perfect my revenge is to move to Los Angeles, hire a Hollywood agent, and get a movie made. After that, everyone will think I am the real Klondike Kate and that you are the faker. That'll teach you. Ha ha ha!
The crestfallen real Klondike Kate turns away in righteous disgust. Then her eye falls upon a playbill tacked up on the door at stage left. It is emblazoned with a picture of fake Klondike Kate in her dancing suit with the words Klondike Kate 6 nights a week underneath. In a flash, she leaps upon it, snatches it from the door, and holds it aloft in triumph. Real Klondike Kate, triumphantly.
Aha! Now that I have this, I don't care what you do, as long as you're not still whoring around breaking the law, you dirty little trollop. I've got my proof right here.
She smugly holds up the playbill.
With this proof that it is you and not me, the real Klondike Kate, twirling around in a skimpy bikini in front of dozens of lecherous sourdoughs, I will redeem my reputation and go on to a long and rewarding career in frontier law enforcement. Farewell, thou dirty, dirty vaudeville ho, thou!
Fake Klondike Kate, sobbing.
Curses! I am robbed of my revenge!
Cut to scene 6, outside the police station. We see real Klondike Kate marching triumphantly up the street, playbill in hand, and entering the station as narrator speaks in voiceover.
And indeed, Klondike Kate Ryan would redeem her reputation that day and go on to a long and rewarding career as a policewoman. But the dancer would make good on her threat. Years later, after leaving the Klondike, the fake Klondike Kate would indeed hire a Hollywood agent and sell her phony story to the movie industry. As a result, today when people talk about Klondike Kate, most people think of the dancer who stole the real Klondike Kate's nickname and got Mae West to play her on the silver screen. The real Klondike Kate, history's first identity theft victim, is mostly remembered only in dry history textbooks and in the hearts and minds of the few of us who still remember the truth.
Fade to black. Great story, huh? Hey, somebody get Netflix on the phone. This setup is good for a good 2 or 3 seasons, but of course the story's completely bogus. The only historically accurate parts of it are the names of the characters and the occupation of one of them, Officer Kate Ryan. The Klondike Kate catfight narrative has evolved over more than 100 years of tellings and retellings in books and movies and TV shows ever since the release of a 1915 novel titled Ruggles of Red Gap by Harry Leon Wilson. Ruggles is a work of fiction that has over the decades managed to get merged into the true stories of 2 different frontier Yukon women, augmented and altered over years of creative embellishments by different storytellers. The 2 women, of course, as you have figured out by now, were Klondike Kate Ryan, the frontier cop, and Klondike Kate Rockwell, the vaudeville dancer who, in most modern versions of this catfight yarn, gets renamed Kitty. Most recently, and probably most egregiously, this myth was repeated by actor and pop historian Matt Falber on a 2018 episode of the Mysteries at the Museum TV show. The truth is that Kate Rockwell and Kate Ryan almost certainly didn't even know of one another's existence. Ryan lived and worked in Whitehorse, which was at least 7 days of hard travel away from Dawson City, where Rockwell was. And also, Kate Rockwell didn't perform under Klondike Kate. She didn't acquire that nickname until much later, in the 1920s. And it does also have to be pointed out that Kate Rockwell was, so far as I've been able to learn, never a prostitute or sex worker. She was, though, an Oregonian, and since 1912 she has been a part of Central Oregon both literally and figuratively. Kathleen Eloise Rockwell was born in Kansas in 1876 and grew up in Spokane and Valparaiso, Chile. At age 18, she left home, moved to New York, and took a job as a chorus girl. It was the start of a lifelong career as a dancer on the vaudeville scene. The turn of the century found Kate in Spokane again, working in variety theaters there, and that's where she was when she heard about the Klondike Gold Rush. She was adventuresome, athletic, young. The Klondike offered her the adventure of a lifetime, and she did not waste time. With a colleague, she set out for where the river is winding and big nuggets they're finding, north to Alaska, and of course points east. The girls arrived in Dawson City in 1900. And found work right away. After all, there was a gold rush on, and every theater and drinking establishment was happy to hire as many pretty girls as it could. I mean, if they could dance. She quickly nailed down a high-paying gig at the Palace Grand Theater, which I was kind of ironically mispronouncing as Palace Grande in that fake vaudeville script that I opened us up with. There she developed something called the flame dance, which involved a bright red dress and a long, trailing flame-colored ribbons, really, and it was meant to metaphorically burn the house down. It usually did. In Dawson, Klondike Kate was also famous for her red-gold hair, charisma, and happy-go-lucky style on stage. Plus, she was a spectacular conversationalist. Miners in town for an evening would chuck nuggets up onto the stage and she'd scoop them up. She'd drink with them afterwards, sharing bottles of wine that cost $5 each and pouring her glass discreetly into a spittoon to avoid getting drunk while they talked about their lives. She talked at least one miner out of committing suicide, talked several out of leaving their wives, and even staked a few with some cash to keep them going after they'd been cleaned out by a professional gambler or robbed. Very soon, she was the most popular dancer in Dawson and was raking in the tips to the tune of up to $750 a night, and that's 1901 dollars, the equivalent of more than $27,500 today. Unfortunately, as Peter Parker's Uncle Ben probably never said, but no doubt would have if he'd thought of it, with great wealth come the great attentions of mercenary men. For Kate, that involved a charming Greek-American chap named Alexander Pantages. Kate fell hard for Pantages. Soon they were a certified item, and she was living with him, living in sin in the lingo of the day. Now, speaking of living in sin, personal finance guru Dave Ramsey is kind of a serious Christian, and so sometimes when young unmarried couples call up to his radio show and talk about setting up housekeeping together, quote-unquote living in sin, they interpret his advice to get married first as moral posturing. He's usually quick to turn that aside, telling them that, you know, without the legal protection of an actual marriage contract, both sides are taking on enormous risks when they mix their finances together on big items like houses and cars and business ventures and such. Well, the story of Kate Rockwell and Alexander Pantages might just be the best, most on-point, and most extreme example of exactly what Ramsey is talking about. Pantages' dream was to become a theater manager with a string of vaudeville theaters across the nation. He had saved up a war chest to do this with, but it wasn't big enough to do the job right. In Kate Rockwell, the young impresario found a sugar mama who could and would stake him to the necessary startup capital he needed to get that done. So in 1902, as the gold rush started petering out, Pantages headed back to Seattle with his pockets full of money, both his and Kate's, to launch that dreamed-of string of theaters. Kate followed him a little later. Unfortunately for Kate, by the time she got to Seattle, Pantages' roving eye had fallen upon a dishy violin player in one of his theaters. This girl was a little wiser than Kate had been and insisted that if Alexander liked it, he would need to put a ring on it, which he promptly and secretly did. And then he coldly informed Kate, who at this time considered herself his fiancée, of his altered marital status in a letter 4 days later. Well, following this blow, Kate Rockwell tried her best to shake it off. She plunged herself into her dancing, touring the West Coast with vaudeville troupes and, you know, doing what she did best. But as the years went by, it became harder and harder to do that, and it was increasingly clear that she was going to have to find something else to do. In Dawson, she'd been in her early 20s, but by the late aughts, she was in her 30s. She was still gorgeous, but like any athlete approaching middle age, she was starting to be dogged with injuries, especially sprained ankles and knees. Adding insult to injury was the fact that Pantages, the ex-fiancé who had jilted her in the ugliest way imaginable, had gone on to build that huge empire of vaudeville theaters all over the West, with his name on them and her money in them. Presumably he repaid her her initial stake after his business was up and running and he no longer needed the liquidity it afforded, but, I mean, because otherwise she no doubt would have sued him for it, but of course, her money had helped build it. And every time she passed one of those theaters, it reminded her of how badly she had been taken advantage of. The only thing that made it feel better was performing, and she toured and performed kind of frenetically for a few years, trying to lose herself in her work. But finally, after an especially bad ankle sprain brought on a sort of nervous breakdown, a doctor told her bluntly that she'd have to quit, or she'd die, just drop dead on stage someday. So yeah, she needed a place to get away from the vaudeville scene, a place far away from the nearest Pantages vaudeville theater, a place to rest, recover, renew her soul. Central Oregon would be that place. Klondike Kate Rockwell had visited Central Oregon before and been deeply impressed by the beauty of the high desert. Now it seemed like just the place to get away from all things vaudeville, to forget Pantages, to recenter herself. And she had friends there, although actually, she had friends almost everywhere among the former sourdoughs of the Klondike Gold Rush. And the Oregon High Desert country at that time, which we're talking circa 1910, was one of the last parts of the continental United States in which you could still file a homestead claim. Of course, the claimable lands still available by then were few and unappealing. All the good land had been claimed up years before, and pretty much all that was left was dusty rangeland. Not that there's anything wrong with dusty rangeland, but it takes quite a lot of it to make a go. And the government had tried to compensate for the poor quality of the land by offering a lot of it, relatively lot of it, 320 acres instead of 160. But even so, most of these late arriving homesteaders had a very hard time proving up their claims by living on them for the 5 years necessary to claim title. Most ran out of money and drifted away, leaving their abandoned buildings and fixtures to bleach in the high desert sun. Can still see some of those out there today. But Kate thought she was up to the challenge, and she did have a pretty decent-sized kitty with which to get started. So, yeah, with $3,500 in cash, $3,000 worth of jewelry, and several large trunks full of dresses and gowns and hats, she moved on to a dry land claim near the town of Brothers. Kate did almost everything dressed up as if for a show. Folks would see her walking into Brothers in a dusty but fabulous and fabulously expensive evening gown about once a week. And there may have been another homesteader somewhere in the American West who regularly wore vaudeville ball gowns and big floral hats and dancing slippers while grubbing sagebrush out of the kitchen garden, but it doesn't seem very likely. She joked about the odd footprints she left while doing chores around the place. "Those holes are not the tracks of prehistoric bobcats," she once said, according to Ellis Lucia's account in his book about her. "I made them with my dancing slippers." She also became an avid rock hound, one of Central Oregon's first ever. She fell in love with and married a local man, Floyd Warner. Kate Rockwell beat the odds and became one of only a tiny handful of dryland homesteaders to prove up a claim that didn't include a water source. But it still didn't make sense to stay, especially for a social creature like Klondike Kate, so she and Floyd sold out soon after getting title. The marriage didn't last much longer than the homestead, either. By the early 1920s, Kate was single again and living in Bend. There she became something of a municipal celebrity. Her home was half a block from the fire station, and she became a one-woman fire auxiliary bringing hot coffee to the boys during fire calls. She was a fundraising dynamo, able to shake down almost any business or person for a contribution for a social cause. During the Great Depression, she also made hundreds of gallons of soup to help out the hobos. She became known as Aunt Kate of Farewell Bend. Less charitable voices in Bend labeled her our destitute prostitute, and it's pretty unlikely she was ever either one of those things, although there were a few times that her finances came pretty close to destitution. In 1929, she was called to testify in a criminal prosecution of Alexander Pantages, her ex-fiancé, remember, who was accused of raping a 17-year-old girl. He was found guilty, although acquitted on retrial, and died in 1936. There were those who thought the entire case was trumped up by a group of Yukon sourdoughs angry about how he'd treated Kate, but it has to be said, that opinion most likely reflected 1930s society's attitudes toward rape victims rather than the merits of the case itself. She got married two more times, the first time to an old sourdough named Johnny Matson, who'd carried the torch for her since 1901 and still lived and prospected in the Yukon much of the time. After his death, she married an old friend named Bill Van Duren. The two of them moved to Sweet Home, where in 1957 she died. There is an odd sort of epilogue to this story. It concerns Klondike Kate's ashes. According to biographer Ellis Lucia's account, among Kate's last words spoken in life was a request to be cremated and have her ashes spread over the Central Oregon landscape she'd learned to love so well. But by then, she was living in Sweet Home. A Salem funeral home took care of the arrangements, and that's where the ashes ended up. Her husband, Bill Van Duren, himself in bad health, moved directly to Seattle to be close to family, so her ashes lingered in the storage room of the funeral home for several years. Finally, in 1960, 3 years after her death, someone took care of Kate's last request.
"An innocent bystander," Lucia writes coyly, "who held a deep appreciation for things historical and because of his own religious faith was able to perform final rites." "He's clearly hiding something," historian Nathan Peterson told Bend Bulletin writer Beau Estes, referring, of course, to Lucia. "He clearly knows who it is and is purposely hiding that from his readers."
But Peterson, a former president of the Deschutes County Historical Society and a historian with a particular interest in the Klondike Kate story, decided to dig into the mystery. Was it a long-lost relative, he wondered? There had always been a rumor that Kate Rockwell and Alexander Pantages had had a love child in Alaska who had been informally adopted out. Nobody really believed it, but could it actually be true? Or was it an old Klondike sourdough who'd carried the torch for the flame dancer since they were both 22, now grown old and grizzled but still young enough to do an old friend a special favor? Or was it Ellis Lucia himself? Lucia was an old-school journalist who might not like to admit to being personally involved in a story. But no, it was none of these. Peterson tracked down the truth, and it was somewhat mundane, actually. It was David Dunaway, the head archivist at the Oregon State Library and grandson of the legendary journalist and suffragist Abigail Scott Dunaway. A true innocent bystander, David Dunaway learned of the unfulfilled bequest and took it upon himself to see to it that this legendary Oregon original had her last wishes acted upon. His grandmother would be proud. Key sources in this story included works by Ellis Lucia, Morgan Lail, Nathan Peterson, and Michael Gates. And let's not forget that dreadful episode of Mysteries at the Museum. I love Mysteries at the Museum. I've actually been on Mysteries at the Museum about four times now, but evidently the Klondike Kate story wasn't their finest hour. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I do hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Hey, I launched a new podcast, so if you like listening to me talk and aren't too picky about the topic, you might want to check it out. It's called the Penny Dreadful Story Hour. It's a weekly, it drops every Saturday night, and it's basically an hour of me reading, at present it's Sweeney Todd or The String of Pearls. As of this recording, we are three episodes into it, and we've reached, I believe, chapter 10. The plan is to replicate the experience of a London street urchin back in the 1840s when the story papers come out, you know, the story papers that the fancy toffs like to refer to as penny dreadfuls. And, you know, all the kids in the neighborhood would gather around, and one of them who could actually read would read the story papers to all the other kids. That's the idea. Anyway, I'm having fun with it, and hopefully, if you're interested, maybe you'll have fun listening to it. You'll find it with a search for Penny Dreadful Story Hour, basically anywhere you get your podcasts on the regular. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. Speaking of podcasts, this podcast, in particular, is covered under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license.
Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Offbeat Oregon History episodes come out once per weekday, usually around 6 a.m., so it won't be long before the next episode is on your device and ready for you to queue up. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.